Thank you to the Weinstein, Stuart, and Terry for hosting us tonight and for picking up the cake. Thank you.
Thank you for
coming. Yeah, my pleasure. So I wanted to start a new series tonight. Again, you know, I like to do little units so that we have a little bit of an idea of where we're going each from week to week. At least I have some idea of where I'll be going the following week. So I came up with the broad title of Who is a Jew? To try to cover and see where that takes us. I have some thoughts as to where that would take us. I'm open to suggestions as to where else that could take us. But it's a pretty broad unit title that it could really take us in a lot of different directions. I figured we would spend a little time, probably tonight and next week, discussing, if we finish by then, but you know how things go here. About the 10 lost tribes of Israel, tonight with a little bit of background and some of the earlier sources, and then next week to focus on some of the later halachic discussions that surround these different tribes, and maybe talk about a few of the different tribes and their claims and the reasons for their claims and some of their customs, which are similar to ours. And then from there, I'm not sure exactly where we'll go. I thought maybe we would talk a little bit about the 13 principles of faith that the Rambam set out to see and to understand, you know, whether there's a real belief system for the Jewish faith, that if without them you're somehow not considered a Jew, and something to that degree. Maybe to discuss some of the principles themselves, to discuss the idea of the principles, and I'm open, you know, any other suggestions I'm open to. I figure that would take us a few weeks to discuss and explore. So we'll start here. So in order to understand and to discuss the 10 lost tribes of Israel, we need to start with a little bit of background. A few hundred years earlier to kind of set the table for the entire story of the 10 lost tribes. So the background is as follows. It was following the reign of David HaMelech. We know that that was one of the greatest times for the Jewish people, the reign of David HaMelech, followed by the reign of his son Shlomo HaMelech. They were the second and third kings of Israel, basically. Shaul was the first king appointed by Shmuel the Navi, and Shaul then, David then is anointed as the king after Shaul makes a few mistakes. But we could talk about Shaul another time. Then David is appointed the king. David becomes the king, and he has a number of wives and a number of children, and all of the children want to be the next one in line for the throne. And Shlomo HaMelech, Shlomo is the one who is chosen to be the king. Shlomo, we know, does not live a very long time. He is basically a pretty good king. He builds the first Beis HaMikdash. David HaMelech wanted to, but Shlomo HaMelech is the one who actually builds the temple itself. Now, Shlomo HaMelech, he was the wisest person that ever lived. We know that he wrote a number of books, he wrote a number of svarim. The problem was that Shlomo made a few mistakes. He had too many horses, he had too many wives, he had too much money. And because of that, Shlomo married a woman, Sheba, right, who was the queen, and she converted before marrying him. But the problem was that she was a very wealthy woman, and she came with a lot of servants. So what Shlomo did was, he took an area near the Beis HaMikdash, which was used for almost like an overflow of people when a lot of people would come to the Beis HaMikdash, and that area was used for the people. And Shlomo took that area and built homes and a community for the Queen Sheba's people and her slaves. And it was probably a mistake, and there were people who were not so happy about it. And there were a few people who actually spoke up and mentioned and told and challenged Shlomo and said that he did something wrong. One of them was somebody by the name of Yeravam ben Nevat. So Yeravam ben Nevat, I'm mentioning him here because he's an important player, because he then will become one of the kings of Israel. So Shlomo HaMelech dies, and after Shlomo HaMelech dies, his son Rechavam becomes the king. So Rechavam is now the king of Israel, and it's all one big kingdom of Israel. And the people come to Rechavam and say, listen, your father Shlomo, he put a lot of taxes on us, and it's a little bit too much for us. It's too hard, right? Taxes are too high. You're a new king, it's a new time, new leadership, lower taxes, right? same problems. Right? Lower taxes for us. Do us a favor. Lower the taxes for us. So Rechavam goes to the elders and he says, so what should we do? Right? Should I listen to their complaints and lower the taxes and make everybody happy or not? So the elders tell him, listen to the people. Right? Make them happy in the beginning of your kingdom. Make them happy in the beginning of your rulership and listen to them and lower the taxes. He goes to his young, new cabinet members and he says, so friends, what should I do? And they say, they're complaining. You should raise taxes. You shouldn't listen to them. Just raise taxes. Don't listen to them. Okay. And, you know, they'll follow suit. So who does he listen to? Of course, his young, new cabinet of friends. And he raises taxes. Now, that was the straw that broke the camel's back. And that led to a split in the kingdom of Israel. That led to a split of the kingdom of Israel where the two tribes of Yehuda and Benjamin, which were basically the southern part of Israel, became the part of Israel which was known as the King Malchus Yehuda, the kingdom of Yehuda, because it included Yehuda and Benjamin. And then the rest of Israel, which was the 10 tribes, they became known as Malchus Yisrael. They became known as Yisrael. So you have Yisrael in the north of Israel and Yehuda in the south of Israel. Yerovam ben Nevat, the one who stood up to Shlomo HaMelech, he was appointed king of the northern kingdom. Now, he felt, Yerovam said to himself, I know that there's a requirement that three times a year everybody goes to the Beis HaMikdash to bring their korbanos and to go to the Beis HaMikdash on the Shalosh Regalim. He said, if that's the case, then there will always be a connection of our people, our new kingdom up north, to the kingdom of Yehuda, because they're going to be going to the Beis HaMikdash. So he decided that he would set up his own Beis HaMikdash, and he made a golden calf up north, two golden calves up north, to keep people from going to the Beis HaMikdash, and he put guards, security, on the road to the Beis HaMikdash to make sure that nobody would be able to go to the Beis HaMikdash ever from the northern kingdom. So they would be completely
on the road to the
road to the southern, to the real Beis HaMikdash, yeah, sorry, to the real Beis HaMikdash, to ensure that nobody would go and have a connection with the southern kingdom. And instead they would go and worship God in these new Teldan, which is one of the temples, one of the quote-unquote Bate Mikdash, with the golden calf. Now that happened in around the year 2964, right? So if now it's 5772, figure about 2,800 years ago, right? 2,900 years ago. So, you know, do the math if you want to figure out the you know, what's the, about 900 BCE. Right? So that's when all this is going on. Now, about 200 years later, the world superpower at the time was the kingdom of Assyria, which was up north in like the Iran area. And they were the world superpower of the time. And there was a king of Israel named Menachem, who was the king. And throughout those 200 years, there were a lot of different kings of Israel. There were a lot of different kings of Yehuda. Some good, most bad. Right? Most of them were full of avodah zarah and corruption. They were always, they had your bright spots. But on the whole, most were pretty, were not so good. So in the year 3154, about, Menachem was the king, and Assyria invades Israel. Assyria invades the northern part of Israel, and Menachem makes a deal with them that the Jews will pay taxes. Instead of him destroying the Jewish people, they'll pay taxes. So fine, they pay taxes. The king of Syria, who was King Rezin of Syria, he decided that he would revolt against Assyria. Right? So Assyria was to the north, I guess, northeast, north of Syria, and he decided that he'll form a revolt, and he spoke to the kingdom of Israel, and he said, let's revolt against and rebel against the kingdom of Assyria, otherwise they're going to take us over. So they do, and the king of Israel at this point was the king named Pekah, and he got the throne because he killed Pekahia, and he overtook the throne when he killed Pekahia. So now Pekah was the king, and he asked, and Rezin, King Rezin of Syria says, let's go join forces and rebel against Assyria. He says, sure, and they turn to the king Ahaz, who was the king of Yehuda at that point. And he says, Achaz, why don't you join our revolt? And then they would continue going to Egypt. And they were going to ask Mitzrayim to also join, and they would all fight against this world superpower, Assyria. But Achaz says no. Right? Achaz, the king of Yehuda, says no, thank you. We're not going to join the revolt. And instead they attacked the kingdom of Yehuda. The king of Syria and Malchus Yisrael, the Jews, attacked the southern kingdom of Israel, known as the kingdom of Yehuda. And Yehuda instead asked Sancheriv, who was the general of the Assyrian army. Yehuda said, why don't you help us defeat Syria and the kingdom of Israel, who's picking on us down here? Why don't you come from the north and help us out? Sancheriv doesn't turn down a chance to fight. Sancheriv was a general, and he enjoyed war. So he said, sure, no problem. And sure enough, he came down, and in the year about 3187, Sancheriv comes in, takes over Syria, starts to take over the kingdom of Israel. And at that point, there were three stages of the exile of the ten tribes. At that point, the first group was exiled. There is a dispute as to who that first group is, but we'll come back to that. The first group of tribes were exiled at that point when Sancheriv came to the assistance of the kingdom of Yehuda and exiled a few, whether two or two and a half, of the tribes of Israel at that point.
The kingdom of Israel right for doing that, not fighting their own people?
What?
The kingdom of Israel right for, like, ethnic?
No.
Huh?
No, it's never right to fight against your own people. The whole history of the Jewish people in that time is very difficult to understand because it was full of idol worship, it was full of sin, and it was full of corruption. There were
both
people
sides.
Killing both sides, on the most part. Yehuda was a little better than Yisrael. I mean, the southern kingdom was a little better than the northern kingdom, but there was a time, there were many kings in the southern kingdom as well who were not the best kings by our standards. There were some good ones. But
some of them lasted, what, 7 days?
Some of them lasted 7 days.
Okay, I got right.
Some of them lasted 40 years.
Yeah.
Right? It was a very... It was
Hezekiah
was
a righteous one.
Hezekiah was a righteous one. Yoshiyahu was a righteous one. And he was the one where they found the Torah scroll and they realized it was the first Baal Tshuva movement. The first known Baal Tshuva movement. What? That was a bright spot. But on the whole, the kings were not always so good, which is why it led to all these problems, unfortunately. So fine. So now back to Sancheriv. So Sancheriv decides, you know what? We now are in control of the Israel kingdom, but he decides he doesn't like Pekach as the king anymore, and he's going to do away with Pekach as the king. So he decides to organize a revolt, and he puts a king named Hoshea in his place. So Hoshea takes his place after Hoshea himself assassinates the king, Pekach. They say, well, you killed the king, you get to be the king, right? You keep the crown. Obviously, that lasted for a little bit. A few years later, the second group of tribes were then exiled, about the year 3195. And then Sancheriv says, you know what? We've had enough. Because then Hoshea says to himself, he rebels against Assyria. And Hoshea says, what do I need to be just a puppet for them for? We can be our own people. And he rebels against Assyria. Now Hoshea was, the Navi writes in Malachim Beis, the Navi writes that Hoshea was not as bad as the kings, as some of the other kings. Somewhere in that word. What does that mean? So what that means is that those blockades that were set up in the time of Yeravam ben Nevat, which was the beginning of the split of the two kingdoms. Sorry?
Yeah, he opened the road. Right.
So when Yeravam set up the blockades and the security guards on the road to prevent people from going to the southern Beis HaMikdash in the southern kingdom, so Hoshea was the first king to decide that they should do away with those blockades and the security guards. And he allowed people to now visit the Beis HaMikdash in the southern kingdom of Israel. Well, that was a very nice thing. The problem was that it hurt more than it helped, because the people didn't take the opportunity, rather they wasted it. So when Hashem saw that now they have the opportunity to go to the Beis HaMikdash and they don't even go, it was one thing when they weren't able to go because they were blocked, but now they have an opportunity to go and they still don't go, so that obviously was not...
So eradicated from their mind to this.
Yes, that's true. That's true. It was about, let's say, 200 years, 150 years. 200 years later. You're right. It's for sure. 250 years later. It was certainly something that was not a regular part of their, Yom Tov activity because they haven't done it for the last 250 years. But nevertheless, I guess Hashem expected that when they had the opportunity to go now, so to not take the opportunity and take advantage of it, so obviously that was not a positive thing. So they didn't end up going. That ended up being the beginning of the end. In the year 3205, Assyria then destroys the entire kingdom of Israel, and at that point, the rest of the 10 tribes are sent out of the kingdom of Israel. Now, Assyria happened to it where they kept going. They didn't stop there. They said, hey, once we're on a roll, let's go, let's keep going, and they actually got to Yerushalayim. And they surrounded Yerushalayim, and they seemed poised to then overtake Yerushalayim as well at that point. But something happens, and they retreat. Right? There may have been a plague, a sickness, something that happened. Huh?
Money, tribute. They paid a high price.
A high price. So, and Sancheirav ended up leaving them alone. And they got to stay there for another about 130 years until the Churban Beis HaMikdash. So there was a period of time where the kingdom of Yehuda existed on its own as the only kingdom of Israel for about 130 years until the Churban of the first Beis HaMikdash. Now, after that, the entire Yehuda and Binyamin, the two Shevatim that were left in the southern kingdom, so when they were exiled, they didn't get lost because we know where they went. They went to Bavel. Right? They were sent on a mass exile to Bavel. So those two tribes are the only two tribes that we know where they are because we know they went to Babel. And then 70 years later, Ezra returned with a small group, relatively speaking, to Israel because everybody was so comfortable in Babel, they didn't want to return to Israel, even though they had the opportunity, which may sit with some of us. And they didn't take that opportunity to go back to Israel, and then they stayed in Bavel. Now, as a people, we were very successful in Bavel, right? First, we have the story of Esther and Mordechai, and we also have the Babylonian Talmud, the Talmud Bavli, which is written in Bavel, which becomes the Torah center, really, of the world. The Talmud Bavli that we learn, we have a Talmud Bavli and a Talmud Yerushalmi, the one that we really focus on and learn more of, and really use as the basis for all of our halachic framework, is the Talmud Bavli, which is the Babylonian Talmud, which is more from the rabbis living in Bavel, rather than the ones living in Eretz Yisrael. So it wasn't a bad time for the Jewish people. There was a lot of good that came out of Bavel, but nevertheless, certainly I would imagine that we would have been better off had everybody gotten up from Bavel and returned to Eretz Yisrael for the rebuilding of the second Beis HaMikdash. But unfortunately, that's not how history goes. So I mentioned that there was a disagreement regarding who were the first tribes to be exiled from the 10 tribes. So there are two different opinions. The Medrash actually has a machlokas, a disagreement as to who the first two tribes were. Yeah.
Were they exiled?
It's a good question. I think they were with Shevet Yehuda and Benjamin, most of them. It's interesting because maybe we'll talk about the DNA, the Kohen gene. There is a Kohen gene. Yeah, they should have been. They should have been all over Israel, which would explain why. As we'll talk about as we go, probably next week or the week after, we can talk about the Kohen gene. There is a gene that they found. There is a gene that I think Kohanim have about 70% of Kohanim have a specific gene in their DNA. Which is now known as the Kohen gene,
right.
to try to see whether we can really know that these are Kohanim and whether they have a specific strand in the DNA that nobody else has. I have no idea.
It's
a genetic.
Their
something.
DNA is like tablets.
No, it's a hand.
The hand.
The hand. So I don't know exactly what it is, but there is something in their DNA, a strand that they have that I think about 70% of Kohanim have.
It's a specific gene common to all Kohanim, and it's on the Y chromosome, which is male
Right.
transmitted.
Right, which makes it even more interesting.
Right.
Wow.
Now,
how did they discover that even?
They did testing for it. Now, I'd like to discuss DNA testing. I think that would actually be an interesting discussion.
Yeah.
We can learn about DNA testing in halacha as to whether that's significant and whether we rely on that.
How does DNA meet?
What?
In DNA testing, they do meet. They create meat and testing.
Well, yeah, we have that. We have test tube animals in the Gemara. It talks about that, kind of. Not exactly, but kind of. Not exactly.
I mean, the idea, first of all, probably the idea of, I've heard of the DNA test. Mixed things about the. I don't know the DNA test.
Yeah.
Right now, that's why I don't really know too much. But one, I mean, two things that seem kind of odd. First, how often? I mean, it's documented how often Kahuna was sold. Was bought and sold like a commodity back in the time of, I'm talking about, you know, like
the Kohen Gadol's office was bought.
Also, Kahuna in general as a matter of prestige. I mean,
but I think they still were actually.
That I don't know.
I mean, when you look at just the family Aaron and what percentage of the Jewish people you would expect the descendants of Aaron to be from. And then when you look at the proportion, the distribution of the amount of Kohanim in any given shul or something like that, it seems, I mean, they're really like, it seems that almost 10% of any shul you would find Kohanim when it would be
close.
Not at
my wife's shul, like, there's no Kohanim.
It's
in the Jordan shul, there's no Kohanim. There's one family they imported from Iraq.
Oh, really?
They have no Kohanim.
Yeah.
You're
kidding. It's just
finding more local Kohanim.
Yeah. They say the community goes back to after the Northern Kingdom was exiled.
Which
the Georgian community.
So that's interesting.
It's hard to
document
that.
Some of the community found, some of the Jews found. So
it makes sense.
10th century already.
Hold that thought. So there is a tribe in Africa called the Lemba tribe that I'll talk about next week, maybe some more. Bless you. But they do have what? Okay, sure. So the Lemba tribe, they do find that same strain, the same DNA of the Kohen gene.
Wow.
They find it amongst this Lemba tribe.
Where is it?
It's in northern South Africa. And they claim to be one of they claim to be. You know, they ask, is it possible that you're one of the 10? No, we are.
Okay.
That's not a question. So we'll talk about some of their minhagim, some of their customs.
Suppose some of their customs are actually come from,
Sarskita
and stuff like that.
Well, yeah, so that's...
By the way, I found out that Ugandan Jewish community, the Abayudaya they're called.
So that's just an interesting note.
They don't claim to be a tribe.
They don't claim.
Well, no, because I remember I told you they converted about 100 years ago. Like
Okay, fine. So anyway, so that's just maybe a point. Maybe we'll mention the DNA and whether it's something that's valid to prove that they're a member of the 10 tribes. Anyway, so back to the story. So there's a disagreement as to who the first ones were to be exiled. So one opinion is that it was the tribes of Naphtali and Zebulun. They were the first ones to be exiled. The other opinion is that it was the tribes who resided on the east of the Jordan River. Right? We know that Reuben, Gad, and half of the tribe of Manasseh resided on the east side of the Jordan River. And one opinion is that they were the first ones to be sent out. They were the first ones to be exiled.
Where
is a good question. We don't know where they were exiled. There is one Gemara that describes where they were exiled. The problem is we don't know what these places are. Chalach and Chagiz and where is it? I can read you the names if you.
But didn't Sancherib, when he exiled people anyway, he just kind of mixed everybody up, which is why they don't know, besides just the Jewish tribes.
Yeah, but there was
the
policy. There was the policy.
There was the policy.
Yeah, just to mix everybody up.
Mix everybody up.
Mm-hmm.
So really
that's why they
fall
under Shomronim.
Right, so it really doesn't matter where they were exiled. You know?
Well, no, it would help for us to know where they went.
Yeah, but then you mix up the population.
Are we going to find them and
send them here and send them there?
It's a good question. Hold that thought also. Hold that thought too. Okay, I can't find the names now, but the Gemara does say, where did they send them to? Here. Okay, I thought I could find it. I can't. But there is a list, the Gemara gives a list of certain places that it does say that they were exiled to. The problem is we don't know where those places are, except, which is also fascinating to me, there is a tribe of Pashtuns, which is in the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan. Well, not exactly. Again, we'll talk about it more next week, but there is an area there with names, and I'll try to get the names for next week, that are very similar to the names written in the Talmud, in the Gemara, about where, you know, there's a river, and there's a river that has a very similar name. And there's a town with a very similar name that happens to have some of the tombstones have Jewish stars on them. So, it's just, I forgot the name of their tribe. Pashtwahili or something. Pashtuns, but they even have a code that they use. They don't use the Quran, they do, but they also use a Pashtwahili, something of, to that degree. And when there's a discrepancy between their Pashtwahili and the Quran, they follow the Pashtwahili, which is fascinating because they have Ari Miklat, which are cities of refuge. And when a person kills unintentionally, we have in our Torah that you can go to an Ir Miklat, and it's a city of refuge, that you're safe there. They have these things.
Wow.
Which there...
Where are they located?
In that area, by Afghanistan and Pakistan, in this Pashtun area.
Had they like, nominated like a coin?
Amazing.
Like that?
That I don't know. That I don't know. So anyway, so that's... Oh, it's so late already. What happens? I don't have a watch. Now I see it. It's late. Okay, so back to the story. This is why it takes more than the 2 weeks that I thought it would take. Okay, so back to the story. So there were those are the two tribes who possibly were the first ones to be exiled. Doesn't really matter. There is a Gemara that seems to imply that it was the three on the east side of the Jordan River, because the Gemara says that the laws of Yovel were kept until the tribes of Reuven, Gad, and half of Manasseh were exiled from the land. Now the reason why that would imply that they were the first ones who were sent out is because the rule is, the halacha is, that the laws of Yovel do not apply unless everybody is in their proper places in the land. So all of the tribes need to be residing in their proper places, and if one of the tribes is missing, the laws of Yovel do not apply. So that's, we don't have Yovel nowadays. We have Shemitah, but we don't have Yovel. Yovel is the 50th year of the cycle. Right? Every 7 years is Shemitah, the 50th year is Yovel, which means the 49th year is Shemitah, the 50th year is Yovel, and Yovel is similar to Shemitah in regard to the laws that you can't work the land, and it's different than Shemitah because in Yovel year, any slave, any Jewish slave who got his ear pierced by the doorpost and agreed to work for his master forever, quote unquote, still goes home in the Yovel year. All family land returns to the original family owners, and in the Yovel year, all loans are canceled out. Right, so the Yovel year has some extra, which is why there's a Peruz Bowl, but we could talk about that. Sorry, that's in the Shemitah year. Mm-hmm. That's in the Shemitah year. For the loans are canceled. Sorry? What happens to slaves when there's no Yovel? That's a good question. We don't really have Jewish slaves nowadays.
Back then.
I don't know. I guess they wouldn't be able to go free. After 50th year, then maybe they would go forever. See, it's interesting. I say there's no Jewish slaves, but then we'll talk next week where there was actually a question about owning one of these, a member of one of these tribes. If you own a member of one of these tribes, or there was a story about somebody who had a slave from one of these tribes who claimed to be one of the lost tribes. So, you know, what is that considered, whether that's a Jewish slave or not? But that we'll talk about next week. So there were a few sins that the kingdom of Israel were basically held responsible for, and basically it was for those sins that they were punished with this dispersion. One is obviously Avodah Zarah, because if you look through, read through the stories of the kingdom, the northern kingdom especially, so they were full of Avodah Zarah, especially in light of the fact that they set up their own temples with golden calves, which is, you know, the... epitome of Avodah Zarah, right, from the Torah. So they were certainly held responsible for that. Now, it could be, the Gemara seems to imply, that one of the reasons why they got it so hard and they were lost was because on their way out, they spoke badly about the land of Israel. And the tribes, on their way out of being exiled out of the land of Israel, they said, oh, this town, this is not bad, it's just as nice as Israel. And then they beat them to the next town on the way. It's not bad. This is just like the town that we had in Israel. And they were, through that, speaking badly about the town of Israel, basically the towns that they lived in Israel, by saying, you know, there's nothing special about the land of Israel. This town that we're being sent to and exiled to is just as nice. So because they spoke badly about the land of Israel, they were also punished. Now, I mentioned that they were all sent out, but then 109 years after they were sent out, some of them were sent out, they were brought back. Right. There was, after the exile, a return of at least part of the tribes, at least part of all of the tribes. I mean, members of all of the tribes were brought back. The way we know that is because we have Gemaras. There's a Gemara in Megillah that discusses when the story that we were just mentioning, Chilkiyahu, the Kohen Gadol of the time, he found the Sefer Torah in the Beis HaMikdash, and they hadn't seen the Sefer Torah in some time, and Yoshiyahu was the king, and they brought it to Yoshiyahu, and he sees it, and he's shocked by what it says, and it's open to the place that says that if you don't follow the ways of God, that you're going to be punished. And this, again, this creates the first real Baal Tshuva movement that we know of, but on a grand scale, that it made everybody, he repented, everybody. It was the first Pesach. We read the Haftorah on one of the days of Pesach. I don't remember which one. He didn't have a Torah. He never saw the Torah until this time. And the first time he sees it, it's about the Tochacha. He reads the Tochacha, which is the curses about if you don't follow the ways of God. These are all the terrible things, and he's blown away by it. And he doesn't know what to make of it, so he has to go to a Navi. So he goes to the Navi Chulda. Chulda was a female Navi, Neviyah. There weren't so many of them. The Gemara Megillah lists the female Neviot and discusses them a little bit. One of them is a woman named Chulda. Now the Gemara says, how could they go to Chulda if Yirmiah the HaNavi, if he was alive at the same time? He was the greatest Navi, he was the greatest prophet in the time. How could they go to Chulda, who wasn't on this as high a level as Yirmiah? How could they go to her and not to him?
It was booked.
So the Gemara has two answers. The Gemara says, well, maybe because she was a woman, so she says things a little softer. So they were looking for something. He was looking for somebody to soften. Not that she would change anything, but that it was just said in a nicer tone. And, you know, he's reading the Tochacha, so he'd like the message delivered in the nicest and kindest and softest way possible. So he goes to her. The second opinion is that Yirmiah was out of town. So if he's out of town, so they have to go to the greatest person. And he was right. He was out of town on business. What was he doing? So the Gemara says he was going and gathering the lost tribes, the exiled tribes. So he was out busy gathering in the exiled tribes, and this whole story happened. And then he brings back the exiled tribes. Now the Gemara says that we know that he brought them back. Because then we have a later prophet, I believe it was Yechezkel, Yechezkel, who prophesizes right before the Chorban Beis HaMikdash, which was 130 years after the exile of the 10 tribes. He prophesizes that in the future, a few years before the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, he's telling everybody, you better repent because otherwise the laws of Yovel will stop to apply, will not apply anymore. So the Gemara says, you see from there, that obviously they applied, and the laws of Yovel must have been working, must have applied at the time that he said the prophecy. Because if the laws of Yovel were not pushed aside 100 years before that, he's not going to get up and say, you better repent or there won't be Yovel anymore. Because they'll say, yeah, there was no Yovel for 100 years. What are you telling us there won't be Yovel anymore? So the fact that he's saying there won't be Yovel anymore if we don't repent must mean that at the time of his statement, Yovel did apply. And in order for Yovel to apply, all of the tribes need to be in their proper places and in their proper areas in the land. So it must be that he was able to bring them back. Some of them, all of them, but he was able to bring at least some of the tribes of Israel back to their places. Okay. Now in the year 586 BCE, which is, tried to figure out the math, but a few hundred years later, you know, after 3205 is when the 10 tribes are sent out, and then let's say 130, 150 years later, which is basically 586 BCE, the tribe, the kingdom of Yehuda, the southern kingdom of Israel, is also destroyed and sent into exile, but we know they go to Bavel. So we know where they went. So the question is, where did those 10 tribes go? So the Gemara has a discussion about this. The Gemara in Sanhedrin asks, where did he send them? So one Gemara gives the names of those places, which we're not sure where they are. Another Gemara has two opinions as to where the 10 tribes were sent. One opinion is to Afriki, right, which obviously is Africa. The second opinion the Gemara quotes is that they were sent to the mountains of Salug, which I believe is understood to mean to the north, to Iraq, to Iran, to the north, meaning through the northern kingdom, more towards the Assyrian Empire, which would make sense that the Assyrian people were the ones who conquered them, and that they would take them captive and disperse them then up there. The question is then, where did they all land, and did they stop moving, or did they continue going on the spice trade route, right, on the trade route at the time? But those are the two opinions, whether they were sent south towards Africa, or whether they were sent north towards Assyria, which is now modern day Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, that area.
It doesn't make sense that they would go to Africa, because the conquering nations at that time would take them into their midst.
Yeah.
They would keep an eye on them and replace their own people in the land that they conquered,
yeah,
so they can control that area better.
Right.
And Assyria had no real control in the southern area or through Egypt to get them to Africa,
right,
in any way.
Right, right.
Well,
that's,
I have a question,
true,
though. When you exile somebody, like when you say they were exiled,
yeah,
does that mean they were free to go wherever they wanted, or did they take them captive?
That's a good question.
And take them somewhere?
So we know by Bavel that in the exile of the southern kingdom, we know that they took them captive. They were crying on the Haros Bavel, Shambhazabnu, Dan Bachinu, like we say in the, so there, then you know that they were taken captive and crying.
Mm-hmm.
Here, they could have been just wanted them out, just, you know, destroy them. So I'm not sure. There is also, trying to remember, it could be that they were sent up and then they continued back around and then down.
Also, how could they go south? I mean,
the
kingdom of Yehuda was there. They have to
go through.
Go
through.
I heard there were some sources actually that, not necessarily one of the ten tribes, not necessarily one of the ten tribes, but that camels, the flight into Egypt and farther, so, you know, perhaps one of the, you know, explanations of the Ethiopians or whatever was that around the time of Menashe, I think it was, I heard that it was a sect actually fleeing Menashe,
mm-hmm,
when Menashe was king.
It could be. No,
what year was that?
Menashe, I have the dates here. Menashe.
Well, the Assyrian conversion, 722 was the real exile. So it would be somewhat before that. If it
was
the earlier, it would be like 20.
Right?
Menashe.
The half of Menashe was one of the ones that were.
Tribe of Menashe.
No, not fleeing.
No, the
king
Menashe.
King
Menashe,
who
was not a very friendly
king.
No, there is, yeah, it could be. I don't know. I'm not sure. But there are also some tribes who claim to be descendants of the Queen Sheba, Shlomo's wife, who converted. So some tribes claim to be her ancestry. So she came from in Africa, Egypt, Africa. So, you know, that also could explain. Some say that's how they went down there.
Can you assume that both opinions in the Gemara might be correct, and that they might have been dispersed at two different,
absolutely,
locations?
Yeah, 100%.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think they're arguing. It doesn't say, you know, they don't quote Gemara. It's not like they quote Psukim to prove
right.
their point.
Yeah.
They
it's
just
not either or.
I don't think
it,
so.
It could be those two and the third.
So.
That's their explanation as well.
Yeah, could be.
When you look back to Israel, are they lost again, or are they...
It's a good question. It's a good question.
The elbow was over, but then...
Right. It's a good question. Whether they were lost the second time, or whether ten lost tribes are the ones who didn't return.
You know, something interesting occurred at the time of the Assyrian exile was that the settlements around Jerusalem and in the southern part of Yehuda suddenly grew. All the archaeology shows that there's a major boom in settlements and growth of cities, and that's due to the people fleeing the Assyrians and incorporating into the kingdom of Yehuda.
In Yehuda.
At the time
of the
Assyrian exile, people are fleeing from the north to the south into Yehuda. Okay, so all the cities are growing. So a lot of the, or a significant amount of the northern people who were able to, from multiple tribes, were incorporated into Yehuda. So, so we haven't lost all of them, we've incorporated them.
Right. No, for
so
sure.
Yehuda accepted them, in other words.
I have a choice.
So then that would mean that there would be no problem for them to actually go through and go down to Ephraim.
Right.
That's
right.
No, but the Assyrians weren't the ones who were... Okay, if you look at it...
You're saying the Assyrians kind of kicked them out and said, go.
Well,
you go wherever. It wasn't that they took them
so
down.
If you look at it in the perspective of they're fleeing and they end up in Africa through Yehuda, that's one thing. But the Assyrian were not specifically trying to relocate them to Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they ended up there as a fleeing
could
method,
yeah.
Not as a definite relocation.
Right. There's one Gemara where it tells us these names of Halach, Chalchach, and Gazit. Those places, it says that they were exiled to. So that almost sounds like they were put there. And there, it sounds like they were put there. Now, and again, there are areas with those names in the Afghanistan-Pakistan area, which was, you know, close enough to the Assyrian Empire that it would make that, you know, we can understand that those they took and put there, you know. But to say that, right, they probably didn't send them to Africa because they weren't colonizing the world at that point.
They might have fled there just like Yirmiyahu also fled through to Egypt.
Right, they could have fled, right, for sure, yeah. Fled, thank you. So there are two other Gemaras that I want to mention tonight, so I'm only going to have time to mention one of them. So we'll mention the Mishnah, and then we'll save the Gemara for another time, for next week, because it's a very interesting Gemara, which I believe I have to research it a little bit more, but could have ramifications for nowadays as well. So the Mishnah says, and we know in Perek Chelek, which is the Perek in Sanhedrin, where it discusses, you know, Kol Yisrael Yesh Lahem Chelek Olam Haba. Everybody has a chelek in Olam Haba. All of the Jewish people have a chelek in Olam Haba. And then the Mishnahs go on to list all the people who don't. Right? It says everybody does, and then it says, well, you know, not everybody. So, you know, Dor HaMabul, Dor HaFlaga, Dor... Yeah, those generations. Generations. You know, Abba Korach, and who else? Sorry? Oh, I don't remember the whole list. I guess Korach. There were some others. I made a list of it somewhere in all these papers, but I'm not going to look for it now. Anyway, what's interesting is, then the Mishnah says, the 10 tribes. But it doesn't say the 10 tribes don't have a chelek in Olam Haba, right? Which is, again, the Mishnayos are listing off, these are the people who don't have a chelek in Olam Haba. And then it mentions the 10 tribes, but it doesn't say. Maybe I have it on here. Yes. The Dor HaMabul, the Dor HaFlaga, Sodom, the Meraglim, the Dor HaMidbar, the people of the generation of the desert, the people of Korach. And then it says that the 10 tribes will never, it's a machlokes, after listing all these people don't have a chelek in Olam Haba, it says the 10 tribes, Rabbi Akiva says, will not return to Israel. Enon asidin lachzor, they will not return. And he quotes a pasuk. The pasuk that says, Vayashlichem el eretz acheres kayom hazeh, that he threw them to another land like this day. And then Rabbi Eliezer disagrees, and he says, no, they will come back. Asidin lachzor. The 10 tribes will come back. And he quotes the same pasuk. Right? So what are they arguing about? So they're disagreeing about how to understand when the Pasuk says that Hashem threw them to another land like this day. What does it mean, like this day? Right? There are two ways to understand the word Yom in the Torah. Generally, Yom can either be a day, or Yom can be daytime. It could also be, yeah, a bigger time. But it could be the daytime, light, as opposed to Lila, which is nighttime. So when it says that Hashem threw them out like this day, so Rabbi Akiva says, like this day, just as this day passed and will never come back, so too they were sent out and will never return.
Okay.
This day, let's say April, what's today's date? April 24th is passing and it will never return. So too, the tribes are like this day, were sent out like this day. So just as the day passes and it never comes back again, so too the tribes were sent away and they never return. Right? That's one way of understanding. The other way of understanding is just like the daytime, the daylight, like this day. They were sent away like the day. Like the day is sent away by the night, but the day then returns after the night. So too, they were sent away, but they will return. Just as the daytime was sent away and returns, so too the tribes, the 10 tribes, were sent away and will return. So that's the disagreement. And the question is, what does that mean? That they'll return, they won't return. They'll return, they won't return. What does that mean? Especially in context of the fact that we have all these Mishnayos and Perek Chelek are all about who doesn't have a share in the world to come. And all of a sudden it tells us, well, they may return, they might return, they won't return. What is that referring to? So the simple understanding would, well, I'm not sure if it's a simple understanding, but what I would think to say is that what that means is that whether they have a share in Olam Haba or not, it's just a different way of saying it. Right? That it's just part of the rest of the Mishnayos. He doesn't have a chelik in Olam Haba. He doesn't have a chelik in Olam Haba. Well, they were already sent out, so we'll say it a little bit of a different way. They won't come back. I mean, they won't come back to have a share in Olam Haba. Right? That's one way of understanding the Mishnah. But what's wrong with saying that explanation of the Mishnah? Why change the language? Right? If you wanted to tell me that the tribes don't have a share in Olam Haba, what would you say? They don't have a share in Olam Haba. Not they won't return in the future. Just say they don't have a share in Olam Haba. So that's why others explain that that's not what it's talking about. That's actually talking about whether they will return to the land of Israel or not. Will the 10 tribes return to the land of Israel? Rabbi Akiva says no. The Pasuk says that they're sent away like the day. Just as the day is never to return, so too the tribes of Israel are never to return to the land of Israel. Now, Rabbi Eliezer disagrees and says, no, they will come back to the land of Israel. Right? The obvious problem with Rabbi Akiva's statement is this means that they won't return to the land of Israel, that after being exiled, they won't return to the land of Israel, and their future generations will not return to the land of Israel. Okay. Yirmiah, after they were sent out, Yirmiah went and brought them back. Right?
Is they talking about even temporarily?
Well, it could be. Right?
Have the Yovel.
Right. Besides for the story of Yirmiah, that's right. We have prophetic visions of the final redemption of the Geula Shlema, where it discusses that all the tribes will be in place. Hmm. That the land will be full of all of the tribes.
Maybe it's in this land. Maybe it's outside of it.
No. What do you mean?
In
the Geula? No. The time of the Geula, we're all going back to Eretz Yisrael. Back to Eretz Yisrael. That's where we go.
We don't need a share in that.
No. In time of the time of Mashiach.
Not saying like the borders will be expanded.
Maybe the borders will be expanded, but then it will all be called Eretz Yisrael. They're all going back. All going back to Eretz Yisrael. All going back to Eretz Yisrael.
And what about the world with no Olam Haba? They don't.
So hold on. Hold Olam Haba for a minute. So the problem is that the Gemara says that Yirmiah returned them. He brought them back. So what are you going to say about that? So either you have to say that only some of them returned, right? Maybe only some returned with Yirmiah. So when Rabbi Akiva says that they won't come back, that means that they won't all come back. Right. Some of them might come back, but they won't all come back.
I have another question.
What?
Moshe Ben Yosef,
Right, so that answer means that in the times of Mashiach, they're not coming back. So you have to deal with that. Right, we didn't answer that question about Mashiach. Right, about the prophetic visions that we have.
Mashiach,
oh.
Yes, but he could have descended through Yosef and just been lost.
Isn't
and we found him
having
the Mashiach.
Yeah.
The question is what that means, Mashiach and Yosef. But you're right, it's an interesting question. Interesting question. Now, again, there is the whole discussion about whether the return of all of the tribes needs to happen before Mashiach comes, or whether that will be part of when Mashiach comes, which is why there are certain people who've decided that it's very important to find the 10 lost tribes, because they feel that by returning them to Israel, they're actually helping in the process of bringing Mashiach. Which is why it could be important to know who they are in order to know who to bring back.
Well, can you be a little, say that 10 lost tribes are going to come back, are going to be
Say it again?
Oh, no.
You want to say it again?
10 lost tribes are going to be Tchias Meitzim.
It's like a Tchias Meitzim.
Yeah. They're still down somewhere. We're a bunch of very
nice trolls. Alright, interesting. And that's who will be back. Interesting. Interesting thought. I don't know. Interesting. She's thinking out of the box.
Well,
all right.
According to your list there, though, how many, that sounds like you're wiping out about 80% of all Jewish population that ever existed. If you're taking out all the Dor HaMidbar and the Ten Shvatim and this and that, who's left? What's left?
A lot of people.
Really?
Also, with Dor HaMidbar, when you're counting them, it sort of puts a new spin on the whole Pesach thing, doesn't it? I mean, what was so happy about them? They go out, they wander in the desert for 40 years, their dead never be heard from again.
Yeah. No,
why is this such a... Yeah.
What are they thankful for?
The question is, what does it mean when we say that Elam Chelik Olam Haba? When all these people have no portion of the world to come, what does that really mean? Right? It does sound like a bad list. The question is, what does it mean when it says Dor HaMidbar? Who is that referring to? Is it referring to everybody at the times of the Midbar? I mean, there's plenty for us to celebrate. Their greatness was that they came out of Eretz Yisrael. So it's hard to say that they were all they all sinned and deserved to lose their share of the world to come. But we can look into what that means and who they are.
Can you learn it metaphorically that it's
could
not
be
actually an Olam Haba issue itself, but the qualities that these people represented are values that are not worthy and
could
don't
be.
Lead us to a more positive existence?
It could be.
Look at it that way.
It could be.
And you're not really looking at peoples. And
yeah, it could be. It could be. I still think we have a large chunk of the Jewish people who would... Jewish population who would then end up in Olam Haba, even if you take this literally and take out all of these people, especially if it doesn't really mean the Aseres HaShvatim, the 10 tribes. And we'll just end with that the Gemara then goes on and actually has a machlokas as to whether they do have a share in Olam Haba or not. Meaning the Mishnah says whether they will return or they won't return. Then the Gemara says that there are three opinions: whether they don't have a portion of the in the world to come, or the Gemara says they do if they do tshuva, and then the final opinion is that they do have a share in the world to come even if they don't do tshuva. So there is, you have all of the opinions there. They have every possible opinion as to whether they have a share, and everybody has a pasuk, which we won't go into now. To base their opinion on whether they have a share in the world to come or not. But so tonight I just want to do a little bit of an introduction to the story, to some of the early Gemara sources, Mishnah and Gemara sources. There's one more Gemara that we'll discuss next week, and we'll also get into some of the more modern discussion, halachic discussion, of the status of these different tribes, and we'll talk about, I'll introduce you to some of these different tribes that I've found, not personally, but through the research of some of these who claim to be members of our people.